Well, I know a lot of people have been waiting to hear my conversations with Tim Gordon on feminism and the death penalty, but I really think I need to give you a heads up, especially in the conversation on feminism and to a lesser extent in the conversation on the death penalty. Our conversation really generated more heat than light. It didn't meet the quality that I normally expect for the dialogues here on my podcast, and I really find that to be unfortunate, what ended up transpiring. So if you don't like listening to combative, tense exchanges, these conversations may not be for you. But there still may be things that are helpful from them that you can glean from it. So definitely listen to them. Give me your thoughts. I mean, if you're not into that kind of stuff, I just wanted to give you a fair heads up. But listen, let me know what you think, and be sure to stay tuned for my debrief on the episode that I think will shine a bit more light when the conversations tend to generate a little bit more heat. Now, without further ado, my conversation with Tim Gordon on a Christian perspective on feminism.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome everyone to another episode of the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And now a dialogue that many of you have been waiting for and very excited about. You know, here on the podcast, we've been doing series of dialogues between people who disagree, between usually it's myself with people who are not Catholic that disagree on very important issues, but sometimes even Catholics can have disagreements on issues. And I think it's important for us to be able to sit down and talk about those disagreements in a civilized way. And to help me do that, our guest today is Mr. Timothy Gordon. Tim, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks a million for having me.
Sure. Why don't you just tell our listeners just a little bit more about yourself, and then I'll explain more what kind of prompted having you come down to the podcast today.
Sure. Well, I'm Timothy Gordon. I do a twice-a-week podcast with Dr. Taylor Marshall called TNT, affectionately. And I've written a book, Catholic Republic. I got a couple other books close to being finished in the pipeline. Hopefully early 2020 will be their release date. One is called No Christian Feminism, and the other one is called Rules for Retrogrades. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm happy to be here, happy to be talking. I'm a debater, speaker, just like you, and enjoying the fresh field of Catholic phenomenon. It's been busy the last few years, hasn't it?
You mean stuff going on in the church to talk about?
You bet. Yeah.
Yes, you and Taylor definitely have a lot to talk about. We all have a lot to talk about in the church for sure. So what prompted me to bring you down was that a few months ago, you had an interview on the Matt Fradd show, and you were talking about your book, No Christian Feminism, and about feminism in general. So we're going to do, I think we're going to do two episodes. And this one, I want to focus on that book you're writing and maybe some of the things that were brought up in that interview, because a lot of people came to me after that interview and said, hey, can you do a podcast on what Timothy Gordon said? Can you do a podcast on this? Can you talk about this? And I thought, yeah, I can. I can offer my insight. So why not just have you come down here and then I can tell you what I think about it, and we can chat just about that. Because I think if people are going to have something to say about a book that I wrote or something I endorse, I would like to be able to talk with them about that. I'm sure you'd feel the same way.
Of course. Yeah, and that was a good episode from Matt, too, by the way. That was his highest grossing episode. And lots of, contrary to the controversial nature of the topic or whatever the ostensible issue would be with it, the up-to-down ratio on that video was almost 20-1 holding for the first few months. So and I think even now, I looked last week, it's 16 thumbs up to one thumb down. So it wasn't just men, it was women of the worldwide. You know, mm-hmm. The world is groaning out, the Catholic world, the secular world,
okay,
the world of the pagans, it's growing out for the truth in terms of sex relations. And
okay, well, let's talk about that. So you and your brother, you're writing a book called No Christian Feminism. So you and your brother are writing a book on feminism. You got a chutzpah, I'll give you that. So I could see two men writing a book on feminism, how that would be received.
You bet. Well, I mean, think about slavery, the rights of slaves in American chattel slavery were the ones being contravened, and the party in American law, we have this adversarial system, right? Mm-hmm. We expect the party with its rights being violated to represent their own interest. So the first major symptom of worldwide feminism, part of the, you know, attack and infiltration into the West, the church and the state and the world, has been typified by this you know, this comment that people always give, it's not a trained response. It's just that the conditions for the possibility of such a response are set by feminism itself. And that response is, wow, like, you know, you have chutzpah, you're a man representing your own interests. Well, feminism is evil. Mm-hmm. And so it, you know, as the aggrieved party, men, right. we you know, make a response same as
but
slaves.
I think what people would say, though, is that because you're not a woman, there may be things that you don't understand as intimately about the needs of feminism. Whereas, and I understand what you're saying, that an argument does not have gender. It's like when people used to tell me all the time, how can you talk about abortion? You're a man. Although, ironically, I don't hear that anymore because now men can get abortions, apparently.
Supposedly.
But that was funny. I don't hear that. I haven't heard that in like the last 5 or 6 years when I've gone and done debates. But I used to hear it all the time. And I would say, well, no, arguments don't have gender. But at the same time, issues that involve people do. So, for example, like if I wrote a book on the Catholic Church is not racist, for example, to, you know, to counter those arguments, it would probably be received a bit more if I wrote it with an African-American co-author, for example, someone who, you know, I can see all the arguments, but there's a difference between being a person and having those experiences directly. You see what I'm saying?
Of course. But see, that's your problem. Never buy the premise. Never, ever buy the premise. This is nothing but a natural law issue. It's an issue of justice. It's juridical by its mm-hmm. nature. And it's absolutely intelligible under God's nature, whether or not, whether yes or whether no, feminism is indeed a diabolic attempt to overthrow patriarchy.
Okay, so let's take your thesis. I want to make sure we get our definition.
Just let me get this response in
okay,
real quick.
Go ahead.
Just one more sentence. So since it's intelligible to all, we don't use identity politics. That's not the mm-hmm. Aristotomist way, right? It's mm-hmm. It's intelligible and anyone, come one, come all, let's just make it an issue of the truth and an ascertainment thereof and let the best argument win.
Okay, so tell me the thesis then. So the book is called No Christian Feminism. Your claim is just that feminism, whatever that is inherently evil, something that Christians cannot ever support. Is that your is your thesis?
We don't make the claim that it's inherently evil because that's necessarily biting off more than is necessary to chew. Let's call it inadmissible fun.
Well, we'll talk about those terms in our next episode when we talk about the death penalty.
But I know you're a fan of inadmissible without being intrinsically evil. So I don't want to stick myself to that. That's an ambitious claim. It
sure.
might well be. But there, as you know, that's mm-hmm. a load-bearing term, mm-hmm. inherently evil. And in order to show that feminism, in all of its forms, it's a form of voluntarism, and it is in let's say this, all of the forms of it that are attempts to overthrow the patriarchy, when you define it correctly the way the feminists started defining it back in 1848, mm-hmm. the Seneca Falls Convention in New York, mm-hmm. first wave feminism. They've all been evil, and they've all been monolithic. They're univocal. They have one goal. It's overthrowing the patriarchy.
You don't think... Okay, so your thesis is just feminism is evil.
Well, no. The thesis is that feminism is an attempt to overthrow the patriarchy, okay. And this is wrong from a Christian point of view. It's un-Christian.
Okay, so
Let's not recharacterize it just to...
Well, whatever feminism is, we can... First, we have to say what you think about feminism and then what feminism is.
Sure.
So you don't like it. It's bad. It's evil. You said it's diabolical.
We're saying it's antithetical to Christianity. I'm going to hold to a non-moving viewpoint here.
Okay.
It's antithetical to mm-hmm. Christianity by its own designs and by any instantiation that it's ever made. So same thing with your socialism book. It's like that, mm-hmm. except in the...
Well, I believe socialism is evil, though.
Well, I believe feminism is evil, too. You said inherently evil, and I just... While that might be the case, it's a bigger argument than one can chew on.
So it's evil. So define, and this is always going to come back to terms, making sure things are defined. Because I
Absolutely.
Agree with you. There's a lot of things in feminism that are evil or stupid or bizarre... I mean, most feminists today, people who identify as feminists, support contraception, abortion. Obviously, those things are intrinsically evil. So no doubt, if there is an intrinsic connection between feminism and those things, feminism is bad, it goes right out the way with
That's just an argument by accidents, though. How do you define feminism?
There's lots of different definitions. I don't agree with your view that feminism is monolithic.
Which
anymore.
Do you choose? Well, I'll go through the history of it.
I'll define feminism this way. Feminism is the belief that sexism is wrong and ought to be opposed.
Oh, okay. Well, that's it depends how you define sexism then, but except no feminist has ever defined it that way.
Well, but feminists have different definitions. I'll give you a few just very simple ones. Well, bell hooks is a very famous feminist who said feminism is a movement to end sexism, sexist exploitation, and oppression. So I think we can just look at it there, that I would define feminism this way. Sexism is wrong, and feminism is a movement that combats sexism because women tend to be the victims of sexism more than men. Now, men are oftentimes victims of sexism. I see this in family courts, for example, where men get shortchanged when it comes to child custody and things like that. But I think a good case can be made that throughout the history of the world, women are more likely to be victims of sexism. And I define sexism as the belief that men and women are not equal in their basic rights and dignity. So we should work towards the basic rights and equal dignity of men and women. And feminism does that.
But men and women, but equal in dignity, which is a topic we're going to treat of lots today. Dignity involves the intellect and the will of a human person, right? Being made in the image and likeness of God. We're made differently. So egalitarianism between the sexes, which seems to be a feminist premise, you're kind of making an argument by accident, but I can't tell what your definition is precisely. But if that's the case,
women should have the same basic rights.
Right. So that's different. It depends what you mean by a right. Do you mean a fundamental rights jurisprudence of the 14th Amendment? Do you mean natural rights? The same natural rights that accord with dignity, even those instantiate, they play out in different ways. Take the first wave feminists argument.
Well, let's go through.
Can we?
Yeah, let's.
Because I'm writing the book. I have all this stuff fresh in my head.
Fine, we can go through the waves of feminism. But I think if we start there, I still think this is a pretty solid argument. Like you and I would agree that sexism is wrong.
It depends what you mean. What do you mean by sexism?
What do you think sexism is?
I think men and women are equal in dignity in the eyes of God. But the church has taught perennially, and this is not even debatable, that men and women are not, their rights do not show in the same way. And this ends up being easier to discuss once we get into the specific claims and requests by feminists.
But you agree here that men and women ought to be treated equal in at least certain ways.
Well,
it would be wrong
in the ways that are in accord with human dignity.
Okay, Then I would say that feminism flows from that, and that if women are not treated in accord with the dignity that they have, then that would be an injustice that ought to be remedied.
Sure.
And we could call that feminism.
Let's define terms, though. I don't like keeping it this nebulous. This is really nebulous.
Then let's go through. Let's go to...
Can I make a sort of preliminary statement?
Okay.
The point of view of everyone who I've ever spoken to, this is incidentally a minor argument of accident, but except... Since I'm not exactly sure what your position is, and you're not writing a book on feminism, it's probably worth me saying this. Mm-hmm. Everyone that's ever opened up with those two or three premises, which you did to me so far, functions under the disillusion that first wave feminism was good. Feminism was radicalized in its second waves and a little bit more so in its third wave. And now some people say we're in a fourth wave of feminism. And we have to stick to the waves of feminism, or else we fall into a kind of hoary, foggy argument over socialism, which has never been perfectly instantiated. Both you and I have these arguments with guys all the time, attacking. So we have to talk about what the claims of the first wave feminists were specifically. They were anti-Christian.
Can I just finish? Well, no, because let me add something, then I'll chime in. I think we should go through the history of feminism, because my position is that feminism, it's an ideology, but also a political movement, and feminists don't even agree among themselves. It's not monolithic. It's highly fractured, and I would say that there are some things feminists have argued for that are bad or evil, and some things they have argued for that are good, and so my position would be we should give feminism credit for the good things it has done to improve women's dignity throughout the course of history, so, including what first wave and even some second and third wave feminists, they, things that they've done.
Sorry, but except we have to treat an ideology which is monolithic, at least in terms of its aims, that way. So we have to talk about what's happened in the course of 150, 160 okay. years. We have to treat it as if it is intelligible, because it is. When you have an 1848, a Seneca Falls convention, and they memorialize, hold on, let me finish.
Okay.
They memorialize the document in something called the Declarations of Rights and Sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
And they lay it out specifically, they model it specifically like the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they say, here are our goals, and here are our means of effectuating these.
Mm-hmm.
All of the goals were effectuated within about 120 years, and the means of effectuating them were precisely what they said they would do. So there's design there, right? We both make arguments for design all the time.
Right.
And first wave feminism, quite simply, the beginning of feminism in its inception, was radical. Here were their five goals. They wanted to get women into the priesthood and into the, I guess, ministerial class of Protestant preachers.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to get the main goal, always of feminism, get women out of homes, right? This and the Marxists that added to this about 40 years later were saying the same thing, get women out of the homes. This is how you destroy the family. And they said the family
I have the Declaration of Grievances right here. Why don't we just go through it?
Sure. It's a long document, well, let me typify for the
then give
the
me the
third
other three
point.
That how you summarize it then.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So it's get women out of the homes, get women into the priesthood. There's a vague oblique reference to the sexual sins of men and a wink and a nod that women need to do this as well. And then, of course, there's the voting issue, right, which takes the form of about two bullet points. When I do dialogue with people, they always say, first wave feminism, that is good. That's women voting. It's like, well, fine. But voting was the suffragettes. This was nothing more than a Trojan horse for the other talking point. Fine. Women voting. We don't even have to discuss that
because no one's opposing it. Well, I think
but
we do
have to discuss
it. Getting
women out of... Well, I mean, there's no point because we probably agree or at least don't disagree about that.
But people did disagree about that vigorously 150 years ago. And so that was a major gain for women's rights and dignity to be able to have their voices heard in the legislature so that laws could be passed to protect their particular interests. So that's...
You can call me Tim, by the way.
Fine, sure. So
yeah, no one calls me Timothy, man.
Except your mom, like, what, yeah. You know, I'm not your parents here.
Yeah, when I'm getting called upstairs.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't want to spend time debating it because I haven't taken a position on suffrage. We can admit that that's at least for the purposes of today, that's a non-problematic position.
I would say this.
But they have, okay, so you, in order to make the argument you're going to make, let me just save us some time here. If you want to spend time on an issue, you know, that's not at issue specifically, it's an issue not at issue between you and I, women voting. When I say, look, I don't accept that this has anything to do with the other constituent parts of first wave feminism. The constituent parts of first wave feminism are the constituent parts of all feminism, right? And they're not necessary properties, sine qua nons of voting, right? Women could, and I mean, it's just, if furthermore, it's not really an interesting issue. It's kind of like talking about slavery or something like that. But I mean, the main problems that I have with feminism, that Christianity writ large has with feminism, is getting women out of homes, the intended disruption to the family. I mean, I have tons of magisterial statements about this right here.
Well, it's not just getting women or allowing women.
And getting
women.
Them into the priesthood. Their naming of the patriarchy. We declare war on the patriarchy.
Okay, because I would say that there are social movements. There's hardly any social movement where I will agree with every single facet of that social movement. So, for example, the civil rights movement and the movement to oppose racial segregation also include many elements that are sympathetic to communism. Martin Luther King Jr., for example, was extremely sympathetic to communism. He proposed a something like a universal basic income for homes. And I think those are terrible ideas. But that doesn't mean that suddenly I think that the civil rights movement was a horrible idea or is evil, even though there are parts of there are elements within that movement I disagree with. I think their overall aim was a good thing. The same with first wave feminism. I would say the main thing that first wave feminists, and let's define our terms so people know what we're talking about here. There were feminist writers and thinkers before 1848. I mean, you would agree.
Sure, but they weren't collected until 1848 is even early. Most people consider 1860s the mm-hmm. beginning of it. 1848 usually shocks most of the people I'm talking to that there's a memorialized doc from a, you know, an upstate convention.
Right.
But yeah, I'm sure there was someone somewhere that said something, you know, with this ism at the end of the word feminism.
They may not have used the word feminism, but you had The City of the Ladies published in 1404, Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman in 1792. I would agree with you, 1848, the 1840s mark the beginning of feminism as a political movement, one that is trying to make gains for women in law and legislature and things like that.
It wasn't. You're making a distinction without a difference, though, and I it's obvious why.
What do you mean?
It wasn't a political movement. It wasn't. There weren't the politicians, if there were any, that attended the Seneca Falls Convention. This was not parliamentary or legislative by its nature. It was just a bunch of private citizens like Elizabeth Cady Stanton mm-hmm. getting together and saying, "Look, we have a problem. The patriarchy." Transmitted through Christianity and before that through Judaism, poses a problem for our cultural goals.
What do you or they mean by patriarchy?
Patriarchy, they mean Christianity. They mean Christianity and all of the first wave feminist
writers. But many of these feminists were Christians.
Sure. Well, many of them were Protestants, right? Same as, you get lots of intermessing between Protestantism and
many of them
forms of political action.
They were Protestant. A lot of them were Protestant abolitionists. These were women who were Protestants who were opposed to the slave trade and were working to abolish the slave trade. But they noticed a strange irony in that they were fighting for the rights of African slaves to be free, but then noticed that they, as women, were not really free at all. They were severely restricted in their own rights, and for many of them, weren't even really legal persons at all. They didn't even. They had almost the same legal standing as a slave, and they realized this is a tragic irony and wanted to fight for their own rights as well.
Well, that's therein lies the problem, Trent, is that we haven't defined. I mean, what you're saying when you use the term sexism or same rights as a slave, mm-hmm. Some of these analogies might be relevant, and I think even in my view, fair. But in other views, with Christianity. Mm-hmm. Which holds that men and women are utterly different. I'd like to read from the Roman Catechism here what the duties of a wife are, to show you. Yeah, basically anyone calling herself a feminist is going to have an objection with the Roman Catechism, right? Many of the properties, on the other hand, that you or feminists might be calling, and I don't really know exactly because as yet it's still just an argument by accident, might be calling slave-like are just simple demands made by Christianity. Let me read to you. Let me give you something to shoot at here because is what they did not like.
Okay.
This comes from the Roman Catechism. The duties of wife are thus summed up by the Prince of the Apostles. Let wives be subject to their husbands, that if any believe not the word, they may be won without the word by the conversation of the wives, considering your chaste conversation with fear. We'll skip a little here. To train the children in the practice of virtue and to pay particular attention to their domestic concerns should also be a special object of their attention. The wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out, and she should never presume to leave home without her husband's consent. In this, the conjugal union chiefly consists. Let wives never forget that next to God, they are to love their husbands, to esteem them above all others, yielding to them in all things, not inconsistent with Christian piety, a willing and ready obedience. So the first wave feminists have major problems with obedience in all things aside from mortal, in order to do mortal sin.
Okay, so this what you just read is from the Roman Catechism, or also called the Catechism of the Council of Trent, published after that council. Council of Trent, of course, Heath Bunn, in the late 16th century. Okay. Uh-huh. Sure. So that section there, how does that relate to that the catechism is giving an exhortation or prudential judgment that women should love being at home, which almost all women did.
It's not a prudential judgment. It's not a prudential judgment.
What is that teaching? Is that an infallible teaching of the church?
No. But as you know, there's lots between a prudential judgment and an infallible teaching. A prudential judgment, for people out there listening, would be something like, even though such and thus is licit, the death penalty and timelessly, perennially embraced by the church, it shouldn't be applied in thus and such conditions. Here, on the other hand, what we have is an invocation to the Prince of the Apostles, saying let wives be subject to their husbands. Then it lays out some specific duties of what wives are. Mm-hmm. And then he says, non-prudentially, let wives never forget that next to God, they're to love their husbands, to esteem them above all others, yield to them in everything except in order to do mortal sin, in all things not inconsistent with Christian piety, a willing and ready obedience. The feminists hate this. I mean, you know they hate this. That's why you're trying to typify it as a prudential judgment.
How are you saying that Christianity, this is? Does that paragraph say the church teaches that? It doesn't put this forward as a doctrine.
I'm not characterizing it as it is doctrine. It's not dogma. Not dogmatized.
How would that be doctrine?
This is doctrine because it's a consistent teaching of the church, just hermeneutic of continuity. It comes down from... let's go to some 20th century encyclicals.
Well, no, because we can do that. Let's talk about the Roman Catechism, then let's go back through history of feminism.
Here's why it's doctrine, because it's all there in Scripture. Let's talk about a little Scripture. Let's talk about, if this goes back further than you're comfortable with, I guess, the 1500s isn't that far back, man.
No, well,
but if you want to do,
you're wrong about it being a doctrine. It doesn't include.
It's not a dogma. I didn't say it's a dogma.
I said doctrine. Yeah. That it's a teaching of the church rather than a prudential judgment.
It's not just a prudential judgment.
What is your evidence that it's binding today?
My evidence that is binding today is that it's never been abrogated. It's the Roman Catechism promulgated in accord with the Catechism with the Council of Trent. Also, here's why I believe it's binding today, because in Casti Canubi, Arcanum, even Lumen Gentium, which is a Vatican II document, it's backed up. Quadragesimo Anno, Rerum Novarum, these are documents from the last 120 years. They might be inconvenient passages, but they're passages nonetheless. We should get into them.
No, let's talk about, we'll go through those as we go through the historical survey, but you're seeing here.
Scripture and tradition, that makes for doctrine. Just the hermeneutic of continuity at its finest, maybe.
You mean what the church teaches, what the magisterium teaches. So we'd have to look at what the popes have taught, what councils have taught.
That's what I'm saying.
Not just our own interpretations of Scripture and tradition.
No, I'm not talking about private interpretation. Well, I mean, you can just play the interpretation game like this is what legal realists do when you go to law school. I mean, I'm going to read to you what the popes have taught in Casti Canubi, which is one of the most recent papal encyclicals that's considered to have a dogma.
Well, what about the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith? Because right here in 2004, the CDF, which is the highest office in the church in preserving the teaching of the faith, says that women who freely desire will be able to devote the totality of their time to the work of the household without being stigmatized by society or penalized financially. So they're saying women should be able to stay home without being penalized. But while those who wish also to engage in other work may be able to do so with an appropriate work schedule and not have to choose between relinquishing their family life or enduring continual stress with negative consequences for one's own equilibrium and the harmony of the family. So here we have a recent magisterial document that's talking about it's acceptable for women to either be at home or to be apart from the home. So why wouldn't we listen to that?
Well, because this is how the hermeneutic of continuity works. There's a tension there. There's a basic tension with 2,000 years of Christian teaching, including the Second Vatican Council, Lumen Gentium, paragraph 52, which is very recent. And when something is new, novel, and strikes a funny chord, which happens all the time, as you know, in 2,000 years of doctrine, it doesn't get picked up. That's a vague passage. It doesn't really speak to what we're talking about here.
What the CDF just talked about?
Yeah,
it says
extremely vague.
It says how is it vague?
It's hortatory.
It's okay. So it's
hortatory.
But
it's just saying, look, this is what is ideal. It makes the timeless Christian teaching sound in a vague way a little bit more like an exhortation or a suggestion.
Let's go. How is that?
Hold on.
Not
let me read
Roman...
from you. Lumen Gentium 52.
No. I want to go back to the Roman Catechism. I want to stay here till we have this result.
Wait. Hold. Okay. But I'm uncomfortable with this because you're pushing back extra hard.
I
hear people come on your show, man, and you let them talk a little bit. I've written a book. I'm all but done.
But I also don't let them take us away. I don't let them take away from the discussion. I want to stay on the Roman Catechism until we're done with it. Then we can go to Lumen Gentium.
Well, that passage doesn't address the Roman Catechism. So you stuck it in. And look, just so people listening know why you did it, it's clear. It's to make it sound like there's a sort of fundamental tension between
that teaching from the Roman Catechism
and
is not binding anymore.
No, that's not right. That's not right. It's never been abrogated. That did not address the Roman Catechism. How abrogation works legally, textually, magisterially is, and this will be hugely important when we talk about the death penalty as well, is it has to be specific. I mean, this is late Nino Scalia's first canon of construction. There are 700 of them. Abrogation requires specificity. You cannot abrogate a specific 2,000-year-old teaching of the church by vagary, man.
No, let me give you. You're wrong. That's not correct. And I'll give you an example from the Council of Trent. The Catechism of the Council of Trent also says that men may not be ordained to the priesthood who have been born out of wedlock. Did you know it said that?
It's a discipline. Disciplines can be changed.
Oh, okay. Can doctrines be changed?
No.
Doctrines cannot be changed.
Doctrine can't change. No. Of course not.
Why do you? How
doctrine
can you say
cannot
that?
Be contradicted. Look, Lumen Gentium 52 says, but discipline can, doctrine can't.
That's not true.
Develop, but that's a highly misleading term. It is true. Doctrine cannot be reversed. Discipline can. It's Catholic 101.
The church used to teach that it was permissible to own slaves or that it was immoral to take interest on a loan. Those teachings have changed.
Look, I know the game, man. No, it never taught. It never taught that the moral constituents of the act of usury were right. I understand, I appreciate that you're out there making these arguments. But the moral constituency of what we today call slavery, the terms might have changed. The moral constituents of what we today call usury never changed. The church's teachings never changed on those. The terminology did, the lexicon did. Lumen Gentium 52 says the family is a kind of school of deeper humanity. But if it is to achieve the full flowering of its life and mission, it needs the kindly communion of minds and the joint deliberation of spouses, as well as the painstaking cooperation of parents and the education of their children. This stuff is so flowery. The active presence of the father is highly beneficial to their formation. The children, especially the younger among them, need the care of their mother at home. Mm-hmm. This is specific. This is on point, and this is 500 years later, and it's from Vatican II. The domestic role of hers must be safely preserved. Though the legitimate social progress of women should not be underrated on that account. So whatever the church deems legitimate should not be, this is actually the best statement
entire Lumen Gentium 52?
Yeah.
Where are you seeing that? I'm just seeing here, this is about, this is the beginning about the Blessed Virgin Mary in paragraph 52.
I have it as 52. Sorry, I cut a bunch of this stuff and put it in here. It's number 52.
Okay, because I'm just searching for a phrase right now here on Lumen Gentium on the Vatican website. I can't even find the phrase at home.
The family
in the document.
Is a kind of school of deeper humanity. Do that.
Deeper.
Family is a kind of school of deeper humanity.
Well, let's try that here. A school.
It's
of
there. I promise.
Deeper humanity.
And it proves
this is a
if it's there
this is not abrogated. This is not from Lumen Gentium. It's from Familiaris Consortio.
I think Familiaris Consortio quotes it. It's there in Lumen Gentium.
Okay. Well, whatever it is, then I'd have to look at the document itself. But that's not saying I agree with you that children benefit when their parents are at home and their parents are taking care of them. But it sounds
whether or not
it,
someone agrees, I'm just talking about what the teaching is. That's clear. Look, you can make a game of it and say, "Oh, me and you, we probably hold 99.5% similar values compared to the first person you or I run into when we go out those doors, mm-hmm. out there, mm-hmm. as it were." But I know that. We probably live at least a similar kind of life, if different tones and undertones, a very similar kind.
You're thinking of Gaudium et Spes 52. That's what it was.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No, that's my mistake. It is Gaudium et Spes. So Gaudium et Spes 52. So it backs up what is taught by the church in the Roman Catechism on... And why was it under attack, by the way, in the Roman Catechism? This is an important aside. It was under attack because Protestantism, and this makes important inroads into many of the first feminists were these kind of liberalish Protestants. Protestantism was an attack on the family, right? As I think you know, Luther said, you know, marriage is just a worldly thing. He didn't have nice things. He had legitimately sexist things in some cases to say about women. But Protestantism is an attack on all or most of the sacraments. You guys at Catholic Answers know this well. Mm-hmm. But on marriage. So it was, of course, as part of the council, the catechism was a counter-reformation. And there are important things to be said, like these are the timeless teachings of the faith. This is how a marriage works.
That's not what the catechism is saying here.
I was characterizing it myself, but okay,
question about it. So the Roman Catechism says the wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out. She should never presume to leave home without her husband's consent. So whenever your wife goes to Walgreens, does she have to call you?
I mean, my wife doesn't go out that much. We got six kids at home, but I don't know. It sounds like you're mocking the passage.
I'm just trying to take its meaning here.
I just found this. Look, I found this, I guess. I mean, its meaning seems original plain meaning of the text.
Anytime
seems clear
enough. She has to go out, she has to get your consent.
No, because I just found this writing the book, but it's reasonably consistent with the Christian household that I've been running for 14 years. I mean, what it really says, it's dispositional, right? And this is, I think, what's so threatening about this to others, maybe you as well. The wife should love to remain at home, okay? This is more than a prudential judgment. I'm not saying this is dogma, but and this is really why you are sitting where you are today. Wait, hold on.
Go ahead.
Defending feminism, because its foremost expedient / tactic in whatever its aims were, I characterize them away, you might disagree. But it was getting women out of the home. This was the most important thing for feminism, which sets itself against directly, diametrically against Christianity, inarguably. And so that's what we're arguing about here today. People are uncomfortable because there was a revolution that was waged. The seeds were planted in 1848, 1860. They didn't fruit until 1968, 1970, you know, from which point on women have declined in happiness every decade. And it's called the paradox, of course.
But this teaching,
is it saying
that it's a sin for women to work, for women or mothers to be outside the home? Is it saying it's a sin?
I don't know. What's your read of that? I'm just asking original public meaning, which is when this was passed in, you know, whatever it is.
It's a hortatory. 1567. It's a hortatory judgment.
It's not hortatory. It's more than that. It's saying the wife should bear this disposition. It's a teaching.
But
of
you
the
just
church.
Said that when John Paul II says the state should limit itself to bloodless means of protecting the common good, that's a prudential judgment.
Sorry, you're making so many analogies here. I'm just trying to stay on the.
Did you agree? You said John Paul II when he said the state should limit itself to bloodless means to protect the common good. You said that was a prudential judgment.
Well, that has to be a prudential judgment because of, you know, what we'll talk about in the second hour or whatever, because the timeless teaching doctrine on the death penalty is that there are two justifications for it. The first, the necessary justification for it.
No, we'll get to, yeah, don't worry, we'll get to the death penalty. I don't want to eat up our time.
But you're interrupting a lot, man. I'm not interrupting you.
I don't want to interrupt and take away our time on feminism.
Yeah, but you're the one that made the analogy. I'm going to get this out. JP2, there are two justifications for the death penalty. The first one's necessary and timeless, perennial, doctrinal. It's the necessary one. The second one, which can change, is what we call a contingent justification for something. The contingent justification for something is subject to historicity, which is what we'll be talking about with the death penalty. You know, prudential judgments. But the first one can't change. That's doctrinal. I was merely commenting that JP2... Francis are in the realm of strictly prudential judgments.
I see the problem we're having here, the disconnect. The disconnect is, I believe, you do not understand all of the levels of authority that come with church
teaching?
No,
I do. I know them
all. I'm gonna put them out for you.
I get them all. I get them. 100%.
Okay, then tell me if I'm wrong.
You know, what you're uncomfortable with what the catechism
The highest
teaches.
Level is dogma.
Of course.
Under that would be non-dogmatic, infallible teachings. So ones that are not contained in divine revelation,
this
but are infallible.
This isn't an issue between us. Agreed.
The next one would be doctrine, that which is proposed for belief, religious submission of mind and will. But because it's not infallible, it can change, or it can be reversed, or it can be abandoned.
It can be developed.
I'll give you an example from the Catechism of the Council of Trent that shows it's not true.
The problem, and this is a recent characterization. I don't actually have a problem with it, and I cite it myself. But this stuff is all a recent characterization from the last 120 years of church teaching. What is a prudential judgment is shoving a particular issue into one of those categories. And the problem, what I see as being at issue between us, no one's hearing any of that really come up because we agree. This is probably the best magisterial phenomenological explication of how the magisterium operates. Fine. But the problem is, I read to you a never abrogated, oft-repeated teaching of the church in the Roman Catechism, and it's repeated in Casti Canubi, Second Vatican Council, Arcanum.
We will go through those.
Wait, hold on. But so you don't want these read because they're strong showings. They make an airtight case that the church does not go around reversing herself, even at that L2. You're talking L1, L2, L3, L4. I know it all, man. I know all these arguments. What you're not understanding is when the church teaches something consistently, that consistent teaching, whether you call it L2 or L3, it can't be reversed.
That's not true.
It
has to be taught definitively.
Morals. No.
Yeah. What is the requirements in Lumen Gentium 25 for the ordinary and universal magisterium to be infallible?
Definition. Definitively.
It has to be held that it's not just that it's consistently taught, but that it is to be definitively held. The church taught consistently for 1,500 years certain passages of scripture imply geocentrism, but it never taught that in a definitive way.
It was never a teaching of faith and morals.
It was not definitive.
But the other way of you're just using the terminology here that makes you comfortable. The other way of saying it, the easier way for people out there that's less technical, and it's an end run, because we're barely talking about feminism, which I want to talk about, because I got all the magisteria lined up here.
But we have to know we're reading the magisteria correctly.
But except L1, L2, L3, L4, all that's fine, but except it doesn't lend itself to the same ready application that saying teachings of faith or morals that are timeless can't be reversed. That's the end run.
Let me give you the counterexample. In the Catechism of the Council of Trent, it says the church teaches, uses the Latin docere, the church teaches that tonsure, which is the shaving of the head if you have a religious vow, is of apostolic origin.
It's a discipline. Yeah, it's a discipline.
No. It says the church teaches. How is that not a doctrine?
The church promulgates discipline as well. Church, a bunch of trads that I know get all mad because as much as I'm loyal to the Latin Mass, trads get mad, and I make the same point to them. I'm surprised to have to be making it to you. They're like, well, a pope in shortly after the Reformation anathematized any change in the Latin rite of the Mass. And I'm like, dude, it's a discipline. Doctrines can't change.
In quo primum, he allows for other authorities to be able to make changes later, though.
It doesn't matter whether he did or he didn't. A pope cannot bind the future church on a discipline. The church itself is always bound as to matters of doctrine, mm-hmm. teachings of faith or morals.
So the difference.
Let's just get back into feminism itself, because what really speaks to people and what the church Trent is crying out for now is not this kind of folksy common sense that reduces everything in a reductionistic way to just our gut feeling. Not that. But what they want is a true sense of what the church has timelessly held, issue by issue. Feminism is the main issue plaguing the laity, much as LGBT is the main issue, I would argue, plaguing the clergy.
Until the year 1800.
And they want, let's just talk about why I think you're uncomfortable with this, and I think people out there all really connect with this. They know there was a sexual revolution that took place about 100 years after first wave feminism in so-called second wave feminism.
Well, let's talk, fine, we'll go to the ways of feminism, but I'm going to summarize where we were at.
Sure, but everyone's upset, and it's poking a hornet's nest, which isn't really what I'm trying to do. It's a natural upset that happens when all of society got duped into not following the Christian teaching on the difference, the real differences, non-sexist differences between men and women.
Let's go through the ways of feminism. So we'll start with the first wave. This is from the Declaration of Grievances. This is women saying, these are things we are aggrieved about. We find problematic. Let's see if they're problematic. They say, of men, have never permitted women to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise. That's the very first grievance that they have.
Sure.
So is that a legitimate grievance?
It's not at issue between us here today. And it's been in a way that I have not decried as problematic anywhere here or on Frad's show or in my book. I said, this is the Trojan horse.
So could we say that's one good thing feminism accomplished was giving women the right to vote?
I don't know. I'll have to think of how I would characterize that.
How
is it constitutively related to all the bad that follows up? I mean, it's not an issue between us.
I think it's a very simple question.
I'm not trying
to be slippery. Is it a good thing? One good thing feminism accomplished was that it secured the right to vote for women.
Assuming that it was, is one drop of poison in the cup of wine dangerous, or is one drop of wine in a cup of poisonous innocuous? Right? It's the former, as Pope Leo XIII said.
Then let's go through more of these.
Well, but you understand my point. The same thing was happening in 2013, 2014, 2015. 2016, Amoris Laetitia was released, and people were saying, look, here's one passage where in this apostolic exhortation, the Pope affirms there are three persons in the Trinity. This is beautiful. That's fine. But Pope Leo XIII warned us against this kind of reasoning.
But by your logic, we would have to condemn all social movements or things like that, because there's always going to be bad actors or not great things
we
in them when they're composed of human beings.
That's what the church has historically done, Trent. It's very simple. Because there's more to first wave feminism than the opening line.
For example.
And what it sets out to do is to get women out of the home, to get women into the priesthood, and to get them voting, and to get them acting sexually in a promiscuous way. It's there in first wave feminism, and people, you're pushing back
what
now,
it was saying about the promiscuity.
People don't acknowledge that first wave feminism bore all these points. You're trying to spend it's wearing out the clock. You're trying to spend all of our time.
No, we have time. We'll keep going.
You're trying to do it. That's the one point that's innocuous.
No, but I'll give you some more that are summarized. Should women have the right to go to school?
Sure.
Okay.
Where do you find that in there?
To be able to her right to be able to pursue an education.
He has
denied her the
all
facilities.
All Trent's doing
for
is he's going through. I didn't say that every word in this is bad, and so.
But I'm not saying every. Through. But I'm not saying every word in it is good. You're basically saying that it's all evil, but not acknowledging that I would say that
I didn't say it's all evil.
I would say many of the things, or possibly the majority of it, is good.
No, look, if pick an issue that you and I agree about, this is really simple. This is a parlor trick. You and I agree that Marxism is evil, right? All you're doing right now is you're going through, because for one thing, you have a laptop, I just have the hard copy papers, and you're finding the innocuous sentences, maybe the copyright information on Das Kapital, and you're saying, look, this isn't bad. Do you think this is bad? It was copyrighted in 1847.
No, that's not what I'm doing, Tim.
Yes, it is. Okay, no. Then get to the points at issue between us.
The point about feminism.
The point at issue between us is you are threatened by people out there are threatened by and are responding with on a varying gradation of nobility with regard to being corrected. Society got on the inarguably, from a Christian point of view, inarguably the wrong track. And most women, 72% of women with kids younger than 6, are at jobs, right? And I can read you what Cassidy Kanubi said about this. 72% of women, and it's a populist movement, unfortunately, now we have to get things back on track. We have to say the hard truths, speak hard truths, and you're not seeming to want to.
My issue is that you're telling people the church teaches something, or it's binding, or that it's sinful for them.
But you're getting twisted off on.
Do you believe it is a sin for a mother to work outside the home when it's not necessary for them economically?
Yes.
Where does the church say it is a sin for a uses the word sin?
Every time I start reading to you. What are you asking? You asked, do you believe this is a sin? And I read to you from the Roman Catechism, the wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out. You just asked me, can the Roman Catechism, and it's been backed up by Casti Canubi, by Quadragesi Milano, by the Second Vatican Council, by Arcanum, by Pope Leo XIII, by Rerum Novarum, the whole purpose of Rerum Novarum and Quadragesi Milano was what, Trent? What did both of those documents say the purpose of wage relations between employer and employee was?
They're resolving the social question about the need.
What's the purpose about wage? It says in two spots in each document.
To provide workers with fair wages, to provide dignity for their families.
No, the purpose of both Quadragesi Milano and Rerum Novarum are to resolve the question in the way you're referring to, in such a way that men can be the single household earners of their homes. That's the purpose, the raison d'etre for both those documents.
And so when Rerum Novarum and Quadragesi Milano were published, it was most men worked, most women did not. That was just the state of society.
No. Okay, 71, Quadragesi Milano. In the first place, the worker must be paid a wage sufficient to support him and his family. Him and his family. The rest of the family should also contribute to the common support according to the capacity of each. It's certainly right, as can be observed, especially in the families of farmers, but also in the families of many craftsmen and small shopkeepers. But to abuse the years of childhood and the limited strength of women is grossly wrong.
How would women...
Mothers concentrating on household duties should work primarily in the home or in its immediate vicinity. It is an intolerable abuse, like inadmissible, and to be abolished at all cost. For mothers, on account of the father's low wage, to be forced to engage in gainful occupations outside the home.
Now, here's my question for you. Does that passage say it is a sin for mothers?
That's not the issue. Let's work
See,
out between
Tim,
us.
You say like I'm interrupting you, but yeah, you're interrupting me. You won't answer my questions.
No, but so here's what you're doing. You're saying, does it say sin? Did it say sin there? No, it said it's an intolerable abuse. Mm-hmm. Following on 2,000 years of teaching that the duties of a wife have something to do with the homestead. They must be concentrating on household duties. Tell me this. When Quadragesi Milano, which is getting quite recent, Casti Canubi around the same time, concentrating on household duties should work primarily in the home or its immediate vicinity. So tell me, Trent, just tell me, without getting into any of the parlor games, why this was a teaching in scriptural times, teaching in the apostolic and post-apostolic times, the teaching all the way through the Council of Trent, right, which I read to you from the Catechism, which was 1,500 years later. It's a lot closer to us. And now we have Casti Canubi, Quadragesi Milano, Arcanum. Mutual duties of a husband and wife have been defined, Pope Leo says, and there are several rights accurately established. He's referring to the Council of Trent. He says defined. Why would it change so much outside of first and second wave feminism doing their devilish work? Why would it have changed in the last 50 years?
So it seems that your concern is primarily about mothers working outside the home.
I'm just asking you a question. Yeah, okay. I wasn't raising
here's,
a concern.
Here's, well,
I'm
here's,
asking a question.
Here's why it's changed. First, for
second wave feminism.
Prior to the Industrial Revolution, both men and women primarily worked from home. They tended agriculture or they did artisanal crafts. Men and women worked at home. Then with the rise of the Industrial Revolution, men went off to factories to provide for their families. When wages were too low to support families, women and children would have to go and work in degrading, inhuman, and dangerous conditions. And Pope Leo XIII is saying that women and children should not be forced to work in inhuman conditions based on their sex or their age. But he never says it's a sin for mothers to work outside the home.
That's not what he said.
Or,
no, he said it's an intolerable abuse for wives to have to leave the home.
Who's being abused?
Do you have an issue with that's Casti Canubi. It is an intolerable abuse and to be abolished at all costs. What does that mean to you? I'm not talking about sin here. It's an intolerable abuse.
He's saying women
to
should
be abolished at all costs for mothers on account of the father's low wage to be enforced to engage in gainful occupations outside the home to the neglect of their proper cares and duties.
And I totally agree with Pope Leo XIII saying women should not be forced to work.
This is Pius XI.
They should, well, whoever it may be, but he makes the same point. Women shouldn't be forced to work to the neglect of their families. You and I would both agree with that. And they're seeking a solution to that problem.
But you're missing something. You're missing something. So most people, arguably, you know, including myself, are actually more lenient on this issue than Pius XI himself. He's saying it's intolerable, right, to be abolished at all cost, that even in the case of necessity, a woman is forced out of the home and into the workplace.
Is he saying
I'm on your side on this one. I'm more lenient than the teaching of the Pope and the Church on.
Are you saying
it's not? Wait. It's not an intolerable abuse if a woman is a single mother or whatever, she's forced in the workplace. I say that's not an intolerable abuse to be abolished at all costs. It's bad, but he's saying stronger than I'm saying here. What we're really talking about, and the reason we're talking about it today, let's be honest, is because something like 80%, 85% of all women, 72% of mothers with young kids are having their kids essentially be daytime wards of the state, right? They're going to school, they're coming home to an empty house, right? All of society's problems stem from this. You and I can talk about LGBTQ and all that and how bad it is. That affects at most one person out of 100. This issue,
okay, let me
feminism,
ask you a question.
Affects so many people,
we both
and it is the primary plague, the scourge of the laity in our times. And you see it.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about.
We'll return to mothers working outside the home, because so far that is the one thing with feminism you've been beating like a drum in this entire conversation, is mothers working outside of the
home.
It's
the worst aspect of it, yes.
But I would say that vast majority, just go through a list of other things that I would say are good things that feminism has accomplished. And then I think we don't have ground to say that it's such a diabolical enterprise. A few other things would be this: protecting women from gender-related violence, such as burning women on funeral pyres, stoning women to death because they become pregnant outside of wedlock.
Have you seen pornography? Pornography is a direct outgrowth of early second wave feminism. And though now it's decried.
Were there feminists who opposed pornography?
That's not my point. Feminism sexualized the classes,
yes or no.
Men and women. It sexualized the classes, men and women, and we now have pornography because of feminism, because women were being encouraged by the feminists to get outside of the home where they're protected. This is a point that Leo XIII makes repeatedly. They're protected in the
home.
But
there's...
Right? They're a physically weaker class of people.
There are husbands who film pornography with their wives in their own
home.
Okay,
you're talking about outliers. What did even... You tell me this. What did even Pope Paul VI say would happen in that great opening salvo in...
Humanae Vitae,
right? What did he predict would happen if we use contraception, and how it would go along
with the
sexual revolution?
The degradation of the family.
Revolution.
And I agree that feminism's support of contraception is evil, obviously. I certainly agree with
but
that.
But except the primary modus, the primary efficient modus by which the feminists operated were the workplace. But the primary object by which feminism chipped away at Christian morals. But formal objects chipped away by feminine morals... of traditional Christian morals, rather, was to sexualize the men, to act as a class of temptors, and to strike back. I mean, this is why feminism has an ongoing fixation with Lilith, the apocryphal biblical figure of Lilith,
when it comes
the demon
to
goddess. They say have sex with them and then kill their kids. This is the fixation.
Are you talking about abortion?
I'm talking about sex and all of its consequences, yes, and why the feminists are so obsessed with abortion. You're not getting the connection otherwise.
No, the point is that what early feminists were saying is that men could be promiscuous or engage in immoral behavior, and they were held responsible, but women weren't. For example, if a woman committed a crime, if a married woman committed a crime, she could not be held legally at fault because she was not a legal person in the 19th century. She was an extension of her husband. So they're saying we can't even be, we're not even treated like adults as being held responsible for the crimes we commit. So they're saying we should
She was a legal person. She just wasn't a voter.
That is not true.
It is
a married woman.
She's a legal person.
Under the doctrine of coverture, and Justice Hugo Black said this in a Supreme Court case, referring back to the law of coverture.
Which case?
U.S. versus Yanez, in the dissent he wrote to that. He referred back to, it was dealing with the law of coverture in the state of Texas, which was common in all the other states.
But personhood, as stemming from the 14th Amendment,
is a
subset of what, you know,
women weren't,
who holds...
They weren't persons, because when a woman married, she and her husband became, as Hugo Black says, when a woman married a man, they became one person, and that person is the husband. A husband could take her wages, could take her children. She could do nothing about that because she had no standing under the law.
I don't think that's the black letter law. It's not important to the discussion. But
it's super important if that's what feminists were fighting against.
Well, no,
and that's
but
true.
You're talking about Hugo Black. We're talking about the three waves of feminism. Hugo Black, by the way, was a Klansman, right? He was a hater of Catholics.
No. My point was he was reflecting. This was a Supreme Court case in 1965. He was reflecting on the law of coverture as it was passed in Texas, you know, decades or even over a century prior to that. And this is not controversial. People will agree that, from the 19th century previously in history, women who were married did not have legal existence. Only their husbands did.
But they didn't have legal existence because of the enfranchisement issue, which isn't at odds here.
But not even voting. They couldn't go to court for custody for the children. They couldn't retain any wages. Like, there were women who were authors who wrote books, and their derelict husbands could take all the royalties from the books and just kind of run off.
Okay, but the church has never what I don't understand in your repeated emphasis on these things is the church has never taught these things. What the book is on is that the fundamental teaching of what a woman's vocation, a non-religious woman's vocation is, sacramentally, is the procreation of offspring and the education at home of those offspring.
Is it permissible
saying,
for her to work?
So you're saying it's, you know, why are you so fixated on this? Because this is the central efficient cause of feminism. The central formal cause of feminism I would characterize as sexualizing the class of women, and that also is at odds with Christianity. But you seem to be confused today on why is my fire focused on? Why is it all drawn on the issues of feminism that are antithetical to Christianity?
I agree with you. Maybe I misunderstood your thesis, but it seemed to me that there cannot be an authentic or Catholic version of feminism that seeks the basic rights and dignity of women, because your book is called No Christian Feminism.
But wait a minute. You thought that my argument was that Christianity is an outstripping of or a breach of the dignity of women?
No, that's not what I said. I thought your thesis was that there cannot be a form of feminism that is Christian or good, or something that's stripped away of the bad things related to it, like abortion and contraception and support of pornography.
There can't, but this is just some kind of nominalism whereby you say feminism in every form it's ever appeared, every form of feminism that's ever been instantiated under the sun bore with it these qualities, these negative ones: workplace, overthrow of the patriarchy, sexualization, clergy. Right, they're always pushing for the same negative things. These are central. Most people that sit in the chair opposite me sit there and say, no, that's second wave feminism, like Dr. Carrie Gress, that she really draws all her fire on second wave feminism. I think when people are being intellectually honest, they sit there and they say, oh, this was there, this was evident in first wave feminism.
Yeah, some
first wave meaning its root. And the root is antithetical to Christianity. That doesn't mean that the bylines in any feminist documents that are not evil, same as socialist documents are not evil, are not anathema to Christianity. Of course not.
But here's my thing. I think that we would all agree that women and men ought to be treated as equal in dignity and equal in their basic rights. And you're right. Many feminists are mistaken that that entails abortion, ordination, contraception, pornography.
No, workplace. Women. Here's the problem.
Let's talk about the workplace.
Women, they were...
Should women be allowed to work? Should women, that part of second wave feminism is just, should women have the same workplace opportunities as men?
No, that's first wave feminism.
It became deeper in second wave feminism to protest things like sexual harassment in the workplace or to codify in law outlawing discrimination based on sex.
Sure, you're conflating. Should they be able to legally? Obviously, right?
But wasn't obvious to people before.
Are they able to morally within Christian teaching or Jewish teaching or Islamic teaching? All of the monotheisms in the history of the world are all anathema to the externalization, to really feminism's attack on the idea that man will be the external face of the household, which is why the household takes his name, right, his surname, and the women will be the interior, the heart of the home, the hearth. That's feminism. So feminism's primary efficient property is getting women out of the home. You're defending or whatever. I'm not quite sure why, but you seem to be covering your ribs because in the most basic terms we can talk about it, this is a threat. Simply, I mean, Christianity preaches hard truths.
What is a threat?
The idea that most women are now in the workplace and that this is antithetical to Christianity.
Where does Christianity teach that women should not be in the workplace?
I've read you several places. Cassie Canubi.
Where does it teach it in a definitive
Vatican II.
Way?
So, wait, no. I didn't say definitively. Allow me to choose my own words. It teaches in Cassie Canubi, Second Vatican Council, Quadragesimo Anno, Arcanum. The mutual duties of husband and wife have been defined and their several rights accurately established. They're bound, namely, to have such feelings for one another as to cherish always very great mutual love, ever faithful to their marital vow. The husband is the chief of the family and the head of the wife, which the feminists hate. The woman, because she is flesh of his flesh and bone of his bone, must be subject to her husband and obey him. That's probably the tonal issue with which feminists take the most issue, right? She must obey him and be subject to him. That's a hard pill.
But he's not supposed to be a tyrant. He's supposed to love her as Christ loves the church.
Wait, you're saying that in Arcanum, Pope Leo said he's supposed to be a tyrant?
No, I'm saying that
he didn't say that he's supposed to be.
Right.
Don't put words into his mouth. That's an odd thing to say. That's like when Aristotle and Thomas are talking about the greatest regime is that of a monarch. And you go, well, not a tyrant. It's like, well, that's the corrupted form of the regime. No one's arguing for that. The woman, because she is flesh of man's flesh,
they were probably wrong about that
bone
too.
Of his bone, must be subject to her husband and obey him, not indeed as a servant, but as a companion, so that her obedience shall be wanting in neither honor nor dignity. So here he's addressing the dignity issue. Being under someone or subordinate to someone mm-hmm. does not mean that you are stripped of your human dignity. Men and women were created differently. Mm-hmm. Man named woman, right? Name, as you know, you understand all this stuff. Naming means a power thereover. Since the husband represents Christ, and since the wife represents the church, let there always be, both in him who commands her and in her who obeys, a heaven-born love guiding both in their respective duties. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is head of the church. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so also let wives be to their husbands in all things.
And I agree that a lot of ways that Christianity understands the family are antithetical to how feminists understand the family, especially feminists who want to undermine it. My concern, though, is that you're saying that families that choose, for example, I'll put it this way. I think it is a sin for a father or mother to neglect their family. But if a father or mother chooses to work, that is fine, as long as they don't cause neglect to their family. I think that's a sensible position to hold.
But that's not what any of these passages hold. So you're telling me the opinion of Trent now, after all this talk of doctrine, I just read from you from the Roman Catechism, several teachings in the last 100 years, which bulwark it strongly. Even the Second Vatican Council is unbelievable to many.
None of them say it's a sin for a mother to choose to work side at home.
No,
if she doesn't neglect her family.
I mean, you have like a one-track mind with the sin thing. They say that it's inadmissible. What do they say?
They don't say inadmissible.
It's an abuse, an intolerable abuse.
For a woman to be forced to work.
No, we already went through that. We already stipulated. Choosing to work is morally worse since it's an evil, right? Choosing to work is worse than being forced to work. I went through the whole thing.
Do those documents ever say it's an evil or a sin?
They say it's an evil, yes.
One commits?
I guess the person out there is probably wondering, well, when the popes keep saying consistently, and the catechism, never abrogated, teaches so consistently that it's an intolerable abuse, which is something that strips at the dignity of humans, you'd agree. Abuse, right?
And so, who's
and
doing
usually the only thing we really get in Catholic teaching that is a breach to the dignity of human beings are sins, right? So an intolerable abuse to be abolished at all costs.
What is it talking about?
For mothers, on account of the father's low wage, to be forced to engage in gainful occupations outside the home. This doesn't even address the greater sin of willful choice to be away from the home, right? And also, what we haven't spent any time on here today that's necessary is it doesn't just say mothers, it says wives. In other words, what all of my friends with working wives come home to let me get this out. This isn't a theological point. It's a practical one that I think resonates with people. Never-ending arguments, gender-neutral arguments. Who's going to cook dinner now? You're getting home at 5:30.
I'm going back to this thing because you cited the passage in this important part of context.
Let me finish this so we're not just talking over each other, right? There's got to be
I talk about the passage you just brought up? About it being an intolerable abuse?
Sure. Let me just make this point. It's not only mothers. It's also wives. Coming home to an empty household. What all the popes and all of this literature is pointing at is the natural law proposition that specialization of labor works. Having two people going out, even if they have no kids, coming home at the same time who makes the house a home, right? The hearth. Well, all of this.
Why don't the husband and wife 5,000 years together? Why don't they work together to make the house their home?
Because that's not in nature. The wife is the heart of the home.
It works fine in my house. Let me read you this part of the document here.
I didn't know this was personal. I just thought we're talking about Christian teaching and natural law.
You're talking
teaching.
About it's an intolerable in Quadragesimo Anno. It says it is an intolerable abuse and to be abolished at all costs for mothers on account of the father's low wage. To be forced to engage in gainful occupations outside the home to the neglect of their proper cares and duties, especially the training of children. But we can live in a world where...
Especially. That means that it's not only dealing with the training of children.
Then let me ask you a question. Can a mother at
home... What does especially mean, Trent?
Can a mother send her children... Let's say she has 3 school-age children. Can she send them to Catholic school?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Can a mom send her kid to Catholic school? Yes.
So would it be sinful let me finish.
Do you
would
think
it be
teaching
sinful for
is
her,
constitutive wholly of all her duties?
Would it be
not.
While her children,
he keeps the home,
while
man.
Her children are at school, would it be sinful for her to work outside the home?
Yes, I believe so. But you're just dealing with the question. Well, okay, let's go back to this. Let's go to the Roman Catechism.
And I already told you that has been abrogated. Doesn't
No, it hasn't. Remember? I showed you. You said, oh, that's not in the Second Vatican Council. I was using the wrong name. It wasn't Lumen Gentium. It was some other.
Well, if you want, I can finish my thought on that, the Roman Catechism. And here's why I can do that.
Let me reread it. Because you said in every case that this has come up in the literature, and it's contrafactual. It's just wrong. The duties of a wife, according to the never abrogated Roman Catechism, is to train the children in practice of virtue, pay particular attention to the domestic concerns, should also be a special object of her attention. The wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out. So when you're trying to tie the non-forbearance of the church of women going out and you're trying to kind of mock the fact that the church had ever used language like this.
I'm not mocking anything.
Well, you're saying this kind of language is erstwhile or whatever it is. For whatever reason, you want it abrogated.
It's no longer binding.
For whatever reason, Trent Horn wants this language abrogated. And
just the same as...
Show me where it has been.
Just the same
this.
As... just I will.
But it doesn't tie this or condition it to anything. It doesn't say the wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out to the detriment of this or that duty. The duties of the homestead are several, my friend. And they are, and really going out, as you well know, you're on both sides of this issue, Trent, because a second ago you said, well, why can't the husband pick up the wife's duties? Why can't they share making the house own? Because that's always been described for 4,000 years. You know, I mean, 3,000 years at least. Go back to Homer, Hesiod, the Greeks, the tragic Greeks, Aristotle and Plato,
the
early Christian tradition.
Have we made moral progress in understanding how humans ought to live or how men and
women should? No, we have come away from progress in terms of how the sexes understand their roles. Are you kidding me? Where do you think abortion, contraception, of small families come from?
Because here's what I have.
Where
did
they come from?
Here's where I have a hard problem with. You're focusing on these teachings from early 20th century encyclicals that are talking about economic exploitation, not about mothers choosing to work outside of the home of their own free will. But we have later documents like Pope John the 23rd. He said women must be accorded such conditions of work as are consistent with their needs and responsibilities as wives and mothers. And I quoted from the CDF earlier.
I have no, that has no, it doesn't stipulate what type of work. In all of these documents, A, you're dead wrong. These aren't all economically stipulated. That's just wrong. B,
none of them say
women
it's the same
work. I mean, this is your problem. You're buying the feminist premise that a woman staying at home, it's not a kind of work. This is actually, Max Weber talks about this in Spirit of Capitalism. He says what the Puritan Americans really did is they deified work as a kind of surrogate labor, laboring outside of the home, as a kind of surrogate for the quotidian grace of the sacraments. Which is the funny thing that I go through in this, unrelated in most ways, is that there's a startling amount of dorky Boy Scout Puritanism in all of the American leftisms, like feminism. Work, work, work. You get all this, you can be who you really are by buying some pumps and going and being a secretary or doing this or that. I hate work and I'm a man. It's okay. The curse of Adam, right?
Here's the problem. The church,
respond to that.
Just because the church teaches something for a long time doesn't mean it's supposed to be held forever.
Well, no, but teachings on faith and morals are supposed to be held forever.
But how about the teaching that it's permissible to own a slave?
Why are you always on the side of, okay, the church taught this for X centuries,
right?
But except in the last, since the sexual revolution gained a foothold, is that just a coincidence? The change is there, I'm defending it.
No, I'm just loyal to what the church teaches. The church taught many things.
You're not, though. You were literally scoffing when I read to you the language about, so what about going to Walgreens? Do you have to get a call from your wife? I mean, that's a disrespectful tone to take to
I didn't
anyone that would apply. Well, you said you're loyal to what the church teaches. Asked,
yeah, and I'm saying that this is, it's no longer binding, just the same as
what
in
makes
the
it no longer binding?
Because it's not reaffirmed. Let me give it to you. The Roman Catechism also has things that are no longer binding, like its description of the church.
I'm asking about teaching.
No, yeah, that teaching.
You said that it wasn't backed up in the 20th
century. Can I finish?
Sure.
Okay. So much the same way as its teachings on tonsure being of apostolic origin has changed. Well, you call it a discipline because it's changed, though it uses stronger language.
I call it a discipline because what's the definition of a discipline? It's an act in accordance with usually liturgy or sacramentals that is not one of the timeless principles of the church. Tonsure? I mean, come on. But you're making an argument by analogy. Show me where the Roman Catechism was abrogated here, and I'll submit. I'll do it. Show me right now.
It doesn't have
show me
to,
an
it
abrogation.
Doesn't have to be explicitly saying the Roman Catechism is
me,
wrong
then.
On this.
No, because it doesn't have to be super specific. Show me anything approaching an abrogation of this, because then I showed you Cassia Canubi, Second Vatican Council,
Tim,
Arcanum.
I'll give you an example.
I'd
the
like
principle
to see,
falls out
please.
Of use if the idea that women must stay at home and that for them to work would be a sin, then we look at the other church's teachings and actions. For example, if it were a sin for a mother to work outside the home when it's not a case of economic necessity, then the church erred when it canonized St. Gianna Mola, who was a working mother. She was a physician, and she was canonized, even though apparently that's sinful behavior. She shouldn't have done that.
Lots of the saints sinned, yes. I mean, do you know St. Paul, before he was Paul, he's Saul of Tarsus, and he killed Christians, right?
Was he killing people after he became Christian?
He sinned after he became Christian.
Did he commit grievous...
Are you saying that anyone... Or is your argument that You said that you could point up a specific, semi-specific abrogation.
There's an example.
I'm not one of these guys that's like, if you're going to quote something for me, I'm not going to hold you to, oh, you have to say the or whatever. I asked anywhere in church teaching in the 20th century, which does, as you both you and I know, seek to be more accommodating to the culture. Even then, is there any place in the 20th century friendly church that abrogates this? I'd like to see it.
I gave you an example of Pope John the 23rd.
And that doesn't abrogate it. Read it again.
He's talking not about, he's saying women must be accorded such conditions of work, and he's talking about work outside the home.
Show me where he's saying outside the home. And by the way,
it's in moderate magistra.
Okay, but show me where he says outside the home. I mean, throughout all these documents, work means work inside the home. I showed you in Arcanum, where Pope Leo XIII is talking about work inside
So that's one example.
Well, I'm waiting to hear. No, it's not an example.
I want to finish up what I talked about with St. John of Mola, because I think your counter-argument was
okay,
weak.
Can we get to that in a second?
No,
I didn't have a reply. I asked a question. It's a non-rhetorical question. You said, in Mater et Magistra, Pope John the 23rd says women work. And I said, yes, all the 20th century popes refer to women working inside the home. Show me where it's outside the home, please. And I'll say, okay, that's one instance, not abrogated per se, but that would at least be one instance. I'm just looking for a shred of evidence in favor of what you're saying.
I can't find the full quote here, but it doesn't make sense. He's talking about work consistent with responsibilities as wives and mothers.
Which is inside the home.
From what they're.
Well, that's why I think it's interior to the home, man.
Okay, that's not what it's referring to, but look at
Okay, so here's how the argument went. I said, I'm not trying to be slippery here. I say, look, here are all these documents that say women need to work inside the home.
It doesn't say they...
You say, yes, they all say that. Literally, people all heard him, bro. Like, the wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out, and she should never presume to leave home without the husband's consent. You then respond by saying, well, that's been abrogated. I say, where? You say, Mater et Magistra. And then you say, well, the women working at home inconsistent with their duties. I'm like, but all the duties point to internal to the home. That's, at any rate, that's not an abrogation.
Okay, well, it says here, the conditions in which a man works form a necessary corollary to these rights. They must not be such as to weaken his physical or moral fiber or militate against the proper development of adolescence to manhood. Women must be accorded such conditions of work as are consistent with their needs and responsibilities as wives and mothers. So this is...
Which have been defined.
Hold on. Pachamentaris, 19. It's talking about when a man works and when a woman works. So normally when we assume when a man works...
But all this, you see what I'm doing here? All of this 2,000 years of magisterium, you want to make a showing, the burden of persuasion is on you to say... I mean, because you used a big word. You used the A word, abrogated, right? 2,000 years of teaching, women working... In accordance with the dignity of women, they're highly, highly evidentiary, though. By itself is dispositive unless it's an ex-Catholic teaching.
It never says...
dispositive, but so all of this evidence, you say is abrogated, I say where, and then you say, well, these two documents here say women should work in consonance with their dignity as women and their duties as women at home. Yeah, that sounds great to me. It sounds like... an affirmation. It's an absolute affirmation. At any rate, let's take your argument at its most strongest. Let's say that did say that women work outside of the home.
Right.
Not that it does, because it doesn't. But let's say the two popes said that in the last 50 years. Well, that's not abrogated.
Why not?
Because that's how it works.
Those teachings are not dogmatic. They're not infallible.
Considered infallible.
Wait. You're saying the entire document is infallible?
No, there are parts of Casti Canubi as related to the roles of women and men that are considered infallible. And you know how we tell? How do we tell?
Because it says, I declare and define.
No. a pope himself, unless he's making an ex cathedra statement, can't declare and define, or else he'd be acting ex cathedra. It's concordant. This is what you don't seem to get. That surprises me, legitimately. It's
I'm
in concordance with... what do you got to be surprised about? All I've said is the duties of a wife have to do with the home. You keep finding things which bulwark that. I guess that's the surprise, is
it's
right that women need to work in the capacity of the home.
In 2004, the CDF said, those women who wish to engage in other work may be able to do so with an appropriate work schedule so they don't neglect their families. Right there is a document of 2004 from CDF.
I mean, it doesn't say outside the home, but.
Well, unless it has that in there, talking about.
Why would I say that? Because even if it said outside the home, that's fine. That's one. It's, what is it, 9-1 or 8-1?
But that's not how we read documents.
Yes,
because if
is.
That were the case, we would
that's
still.
Not how abrogation works.
If that's how it worked, then we would still own slaves and think the earth is at the center of the universe.
You're being silly now.
No, that's.
You're being silly. You're making a popular appeal. That's not right. Abrogation does not function where one pope that's not defining anything, that's not making an ex cathedra statement, or else the church would be in a ruins, right? In the pontificate of Francis over the last 7 years, everything would be the opposite, right? Jesus would be outside of the Holy Trinity, for heaven's sakes. That's not how the church works. That's not how the hermeneutic of continuity works.
Under your
trads
example.
Get mad at me because I defend the hermeneutic of continuity. They say horrible things. Oh, this guy's phony, blah, blah, blah. The hermeneutic of continuity is something, I'm not being cheeky. I thought we agreed about coming in here. The whole way that it works is when there's something that's not consonant, that's outlier, you know, that doesn't work for ex cathedra statements. But when there's something lower than that, that's outlier to 2,000 years of Christian teaching, it's just, you just simply say, well, this is outlier and it's vague. We don't know what it means because God cannot sustain in the moral law or the rules of faith, cannot sustain breaches of the rule of non-contradiction, right? Even God.
That's
is
not true. In Donum Veritatis,
it's not true. Yeah, it is.
In Donum Veritatis, the church taught that the church's intervention in the prudential order can be mistaken. It can be mistaken in some cases when it's not infallibly taught.
In the prudential order.
That would include things like whether or not the use of torture is acceptable. Paragraph 2298 of the Catechism says that
it was
regrettable that the church used these practices in the past. That was a mistake. And the same could be said about mandates related to let me get to the point about when work from home. What is the problem for me? Let me articulate this. I am extremely concerned that you're fashioning a heavy burden on people and unduly exercising their consciences, saying some behavior they're doing is sinful when it's not, because otherwise the church made an error in canonizing St. Gianna Mola. Would the church canonize someone who is engaged in obvious, persistent grave sin?
I don't know when she stopped, but okay. So what you're pointing out is a tension. It's not a contradiction. Would the church, in all of these documents for 1970 years, shocker, the change comes with the sexual revolution. Would the church teach wrongly for 1970 years? Are you of the position that the church can teach wrongly for 1970 years? That's not how the hermeneutic of continuity works.
The church can make an error over a long period of time.
No, it cannot make an error over a long period
Who
of time.
Who says that? Where does the church say
this
that?
Comes direct, I don't know, I learned it in magisterium class. A church can make, when it's at L1, L2, it can say something that's not picked up by later documents. Absolutely, look it up afterwards. The church can't teach for 1970 years wrongly about the fundamental duties of a woman's vocation, right? About the fundamental rapport between man and woman.
But we're not disagreeing. I agree
I
agree women are naturally ordered towards raising children and helping to educate them. But it doesn't follow from that they can never work outside of the home. That is a later application, and that it never became an issue in the church because women didn't work outside the home until the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th century.
Even though it's called, in the 20th century no less, an intolerable abuse and to be abolished at all costs, that mothers would do it forcibly, which is presumed by the Aristotomist standards of culpability, forcibly would be less morally accountable than willing to do it.
That's only with an evil, because I could be forced to do something
it's an
that
abuse.
Is good.
Call it an abuse.
No, because if you force someone to be baptized, that doesn't mean choosing to be baptized is evil.
Concentrating on household duties should work primarily in the home or its immediate vicinity. I don't know how you get clearer than this. This is Quadragesimo Anno 71. Lumen Gentium, 52. Which Vatican? I have it written down the wrong way. Number 52.
Could those teachings ever
Gaudium
be? Could they ever be reversed?
This comes directly out of Gaudium et Spes, which they haven't been. that, as we've shown here today, the active presence of the father is highly beneficial to the children's formation. The children, especially the younger of them, need the care of their mother at home. This domestic role of hers must be safely preserved. I mean, I don't know what else you want. And it seems to me, I think there's a real danger of you seeming slippery on this issue because there's such a robust tradition of there's a robust
mothers...
tradition of women should stay at home and unless necessity compels her
does
to go
all,
out of the home.
Does that mean all mothers have to homeschool?
No.
I thought children need the care of their mother at home. Are they being sent to school?
You're asking rhetorical questions to a dead document. These are dead letters, but they live on in the spirit of the faithful, of course. But I mean, you're literally interrogating the document, man. The wife should love to remain at home. This addresses not just her acts, but something that's interior, her disposition. She should love to remain at home. It seems like you have a problem with this, and you're getting upset at me about it.
So you're also saying then that priests born out of wedlock should not be admitted to the priesthood.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
The Roman Catechism and the 1917 Code of Canon Law prohibits priests, men born out of wedlock, from being ordained to the priesthood.
Right, but that wasn't taught in Casti Canubi, Arcanum. Quadragesimo.
Okay, so now you're creating new criteria then. It was in the Roman Catechism and the 1917 Code of Canon Law. The only
My
thing
opening
that replaces
salvo
it.
Was this was in the Roman Catechism, right? And it's never been abrogated the way tonsure or whatever obscure, banality from church history you're dragging up was. But it's also been bulwarked because you scoffed at the language as erstwhile.
You're not appreciating it. That was considered something that monks and religious had to do because that tradition was received from the apostles.
Are you saying it's not a discipline? It's disciplinary. Some disciplines come from the apostles.
The act of choosing to receive that cutting is a discipline, but the belief that this teaching comes from the apostles was something the church taught. It no longer teaches that anymore, as per the 1908 Catholic Encyclopedia that has an imprimatur.
But what's your point?
My point is that you're wrong about doctrine that is not infallible. It certainly can change or it can be reversed.
No, that's a discipline, the tonsure thing. We can look it up afterwards and weigh in, or you could
or
add
other,
it to the
and
end.
I already gave you two
Tonsure's
more. I already
discipline.
Gave you two moral teachings. Would you agree that it is wrong to place someone in indentured servitude? You ought not own a slave.
Well, indentured servant isn't slave in the American
parlance. Do you think people in the modern age should have indentured servants?
But look, I don't know. I'd have to think about it and get back to you. Indentured servitude is not slavery. The moral dictates that we are called to by indentured servitude versus the moral imperatives of slavery are not identical.
Okay, so then people shouldn't own
slaves. It's not an issue that interests me, so I don't really care.
People shouldn't own slaves.
What interests me here is that
no, I'm showing
this is
a
consistent teaching.
There's
of the
a change
church.
Right there. The Council of Gongra in the 4th century said it was a sin to free a slave. That was a regional council, and popes affirmed that.
But you're not producing. Nor does it matter to me. I'm not saying
that teaching has changed.
I didn't even say catechisms. I thought you would go here. Catechisms are not magisterial documents.
They are magisterial, but not all of their teachings.
They're not magisterial documents insofar as they create nothing new. They're summaries.
What is included in them has the same weight as what came before.
Sure, which is what a synopsis is. So I thought you would hit me with, hey, look, these things can be updated. There can be errors in catechism. Of course, all I'm saying here today, and you haven't wanted to talk about the natural ramifications of this very much because second and third wave feminism destroyed everything in culture and really coming directly from first wave feminism. You wanted to talk about it from the magisteria, and that's great by me. All I'm saying is the magisteria is utterly self-consistent. It's not, you don't find a late 19th century after the Industrial Revolution or the earlier mid 20th century after the Industrial Revolution saying anything materially different from what the Catechism of Trent says. It's all there. It's all up in black and white. And even Rerum Novarum and Quadragesimo Anno, guys like me and you that defend markets and are out there defending markets, we love them. They say that the whole purpose of these two documents is so that men can be the single wage earners. So I mean, I don't know. I'm not. I'm a philosopher. I'm not a theologian. So you grew an obsession throughout the course of this debate. Well, is it a sin? What level of sin? All we know is the church has been really, really consistent.
I agree that it's an ideal.
Not that it's an ideal. That it's using language like intolerable abuse, necessary.
The one who's saying it's a sin then.
The woman should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out. To me,
do you think the Roman Catechism was right when it said there are only two parts of the church, triumphant in heaven and militant on earth?
Obviously not. But
okay, so it could be an error.
Yes, but as you've been making this point, banging this drum for the last 8 or 9 minutes, this is clearly not an error. This is crystal clear that the teaching is bulwarked as we go even into the 20th century, even the Second Vatican Council. I mean, can you give me some credit? I'm sitting here writing a book, and when my brother found that passage, I was stymied. I was shocked that in the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes, not Lumen Gentium, you're right on that, backs up what we're saying that comes from Arcanum, Leo
XIII. But it's talking about the needs of children. It's talking about the importance of family. You would agree. None of these passages ever say, and a woman shall not work out. A mother shall not work outside of the home. It is a sin for her to work outside of the home.
No, they do
it
say a woman shall not work outside of the home. Casti Canubi says this. Quadragesima Milano implies it, and the Roman Catechism is very clear about
Never says it's a sin for them to do that. That it's an evil, or that it's
an abuse for them to be forced outside.
Yeah, the women are abused to do that. Just like it's an abuse to force someone to be baptized.
So, okay,
but it's okay to choose to be baptized.
Let's talk about what an abuse would be. You know,
and forcing a woman to work in a coal mine or a child what Leo's
talking about.
About
human agency. That's wrong. It says she should not be forced in the passive tense by conditions, right? By the impoverishment of, you know, her husband's low wage, meaning that is an evil. That is an ill. So a low wage, and this is why it becomes popular for guilds and labor people to talk about Rerum and Quadragesimo. This is why because they think it's a justification for what they're going to do with social organization and whatnot. It's an ill. It's a clear ill for a woman to have to do something bad, right? Which is to leave the home. It's an abuse for her to be forced by those
conditions.
It's
an abuse for her to do things that Pope Leo says are ill-suited for her, that sap her strength, just like it's an abuse to force men to work in inhuman factory conditions. Anywho, we're at the end of our
time.
Can
I read one more passage?
How about each of us gets a closing thought? Because I want to have time for you and I to talk about the death penalty. We're already gone for, I think, like an hour and 40.
Sure.
So just to summarize, thoughts on how should Christians view feminism? I'll say a last word and you have a last word and we'll just, how does that sound?
That's fine.
Okay. Here's my thought on feminism. I would say that there are a lot of things that are bad in modern feminism and even things in first wave feminism, like trying to make women priests or say women can be as immoral as men. Sure. But also I think that feminism, if it is defined as opposition to sexism and the belief that men and women should be treated equal in dignity and in basic rights, that's a good thing as Catholics can embrace. It gives us, that's good for women to have the right to vote, the right to work, for marital rape to be illegal, for violence against women to be illegal, so that women can be treated in equal and dignity with men. I think that Catholics and Christians can take some kind of form of feminism that seeks that equality, and there's nothing wrong with that.
All right. So throughout all of today, through this fruitful debate, you've been defining feminism in terms of its accidental properties. I've been defining feminism in terms of its essential properties, what's always there. And what has always been there in the waves of feminism, there are four now, historical Western civilizational waves of feminism, are these properties. You listed them. They're bad. Central are getting women outside the home and sexualizing them in one, in two, in three, in four. And they become more apparent and more aggressive as they go. What one can do if one is being obfuscating is say, I'm going to pick a new secret definition of this thing, feminism, and I'm going to make it a good thing. Can that be done? Sure, you could do it with socialism. The reason the church has condemned socialism, though, time and again, as you know, you're writing the book on it, is because it has essential properties that always co-occur. Let me say that again, that always co-occur. In every single argument for a Christian feminism, there is some corollary that always appears. It's that first wave feminism is good. You're the first person I've ever debated about this that didn't make the argument, well, first wave feminism didn't have these toxic essential properties, because you have the document from 1848 there, so you know. It's an essential property of the thing. And yes, feminism is not the opposition of sexism. That's not what has appeared in all of its appearances. The essential property of feminism that's always with us, like Jesus says of the poor, is an overthrow of Christian patriarchy. And therefore, trying to come up or fabricate, or if it's true, I guess identify and describe a so-called Christian feminism is a circular square, right? Which is not, according to the Pope and Cassie Canubi, the true emancipation of woman. He's rebutting it. Nor the rational and exalted liberty which belongs to the noble office of a Christian woman and wife. It's the home. The home is the regal place.
Well, we'll have to, people can check out. When's the book come out?
Unfortunately, it's got bumped a little, probably February of 2020.
Oh, that's soon.
Yeah.
So we'll have to check it out and then get the whole case there. So, Tim, this is the most vigorous conversation I've had on the podcast, but I think it's because brothers are more apt to swing a bit more than strangers are. So
it's true.
So, brother, I'm glad you're here. And then let's do part two here in a little bit.
You bet.
All right.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.